Hey, Adam.
Yes, Mike.
We're not behind a paywall anymore.
We are not. Shockingly, somewhat 16 years after starting at, well, it wasn't even Wrestling Observer at that point. It was F4WOnline.com, being the original alternate, both in terms of the tagline and in reality, the first non-Brian Alvarez, non-Brian and Vinny, non-Brian and Dave show over on the Observer site. We are now free.
I feel like doing that Keith Olbermann bit when he went to ESPN2 when that first started, where he broke out of Stanford and then I guess to a different part of Stanford and to a different part of the studio so he could start up ESPN2. But yes, we finally escaped from behind the paywall, and we actually predate Dave Meltzer. That's how long we've been here. We've been here since about 6 8 months maybe after the website itself started, the old version F4W Online. That's when we came over and started doing the Adam and Mike Big Audio Nightmare, which at the time covered a lot more ice hockey and K1 and Pride and things like that, which were big at the time. Even sumo, we would talk about all of these things that would take place over in Japan when it came to the manly arts of fighting. But as
You would
time
threaten to talk about boxing here on this
That's
podcast.
true, and I even have slipped it in there at sometimes. But yeah, we're actually back out from behind the paywall now, and mostly just talking about Japanese professional wrestling as it relates to New Japan, All Japan, NOAH, DDT, Stardom, and all sorts of promotions like that. So if you're listening to us for the first time, welcome. If you've been listening to us for a long time, welcome back. We're here with another show again, and we promise. Every once in a while, for those people who've been listening for a long time, we promise we'll talk a little bit about hockey at some point.
Yes, that is absolutely true. But to your point, since March of 2006, we have been doing this show together. Some 450 odd shows. If you do want to subscribe to the Wrestling Observer website and go deep into the archives, you can go all the way back, like I said, to March of 2006 through, what you and I have talked about quite a bit here was for some people, including some people that ran the website that we were on, that we continue to be on, a dark time in Japan, meaning that to some people, nothing was happening in Japan. In reality, a lot was happening in Japan, and we were the ones covering it. The discussions have changed a little bit. Like you said, back then we maybe talked a little bit more hockey than we do now. We also, there were different topics to discuss. Back then, it was, who's more charismatic? Who's ready to lead New Japan in the new generation, in the new era? Hiroshi Tanahashi or Shinsuke Nakamura? We had some long knockdown, drag-out arguments about that. And then we also commiserated about Pro Wrestling NOAH. Very different than commiserating about Pro Wrestling NOAH now. Back then, it was, why aren't they making Mara Fuji and Kenta the top stars? Why are they not developing new wrestlers? Eventually, their luck is going to run out. It did. And yeah, so the topics have changed a little bit, but we have not. We are still here.
And really, the topics haven't changed either because we're going to be talking about New Japan and NOAH today. But yeah, we've been around for so long. All of these other people that have come along and done shows about Japanese wrestling, they're our kids. They all are birthed from us, and that some of them were so inspired by us. Some of them said, these guys suck. We can do a better job. And a lot of people have done shows, but this is the original, as we mentioned, the original alternate here at F4WOnline.com, the Adam and Mike Big Audio Nightmare. And there is a significant amount going on. Forget about there's nothing happening in Japan. There's a lot happening in Japan. Some of it even good, Adam, and a lot of it weird, and some of it
Yes.
troubling in some ways. So I'm not sure what you want to start with today, but there is a lot to get into.
Yeah, I mean, we have the Best of the Super Junior tournament to talk about, which that's from a in-ring perspective, that's the biggest news of the past week, the past couple of weeks, particularly given the fact that after several years of very similar tournaments with just the relatively small core of contracted junior heavyweights that New Japan has, we've seen, like I said, the last few years very similar. Now, foreigners have come in. We've got wrestlers from AEW, CMLL, Impact Wrestling, great so many other places, it's made for a more interesting tournament. And we'll get there. But I want to piggyback a little bit off of something that you had just talked about as we record this less than an hour ago. Some discussion about the situation in Dragon Gate and Pro Wrestling Noah as it relates to the man who just won't go away. If you follow this podcast, if you follow me at Adam of the Ban on Twitter, if you follow Mike has talked about it at Wrestling Observer Live, or what I have written about to the Three Count Fall newsletter, you know that Nosawa Rongai has been at the center of a lot of things over the past couple of years, particularly booking Pro Wrestling Noah into the ground. The thought, as of a couple of weeks ago, was that Nosawa was out of Pro Wrestling Noah after their much documented two back-to-back shows at Sumo Hall, which drew terribly, that he was out at Noah. He showed up the next day in Dragon Gate, won the six-man tag team titles, and figured, okay, that's kind of the situation. He's going to wrestle in Dragon Gate, not be a part of the office, not be involved in the booking in any way, and he's gone from Pro Wrestling Noah entirely. Then, just a couple days ago, Pro Wrestling Noah has what in theory was a major show at Ota War Gymnasium, Keiji Muto's return match that drew just 924 fans. And who shows up? Nosawa Rongai. And after he shows up, who says he's recontracted with Pro Wrestling Noah and his profile is back up on the website? It's Nosawa Rongai. And apparently this is something that is, you know, not just rubbing some Western fans the wrong way, but it has also apparently ruffled some feathers in the Dragon Gate office as well.
Seems like it. Certainly is, I guess, maybe affected the roster. But is Brian Alvarez, of all people, your source for Dragon Gate news?
That's what I would think, for sure. That's definitely who I would think would have the breaking news, but I don't think he would say it if he didn't have some he didn't have some sourcing on it.
I know that he does, and Dave Meltzer is going to talk about it more, and I have a feeling that many of you are going to be hearing this show before you hear Dave and Brian review Raw and do their Tuesday morning Wrestling Observer radio show, where Dave is probably going to have much more on this issue. But it seems as if Nosawa's tentacles in Dragon Gate are more than what some wish they were. It does not seem as if he's got direct impact on the booking, but he's got enough influence where his ideas are being, I guess, taken into account a little bit more than some people would like them to be. And he's exerting some influence there with whoever it is. So as he looked like he was going to exit Noah, he did bring up the fact that he had some Mexican money mark, or there was something going on where he would be, you know, he had a deal set up, you know. Was that just a, you know, a sleight of hand, some obfuscation, or what, I forget what the word would be, but is that just,
obfuscation?
You know, obfuscation?
Obfuscation.
Look, I hear using the big words and whatnot, but like, you know, was that a sleight of hand, you know, because he was having something, trying to set up something with Dragon Gate. And it seems as if, according to Brian, there are people that know that they cannot get their word out in the Japanese newspapers and in the Japanese media because they don't want to ruffle any feathers with the office. The media doesn't. So they're figuring we're going to go to the West. So we'll see, you know, Voices of Wrestling has people, you know, Post Wrestling has people, you know, we have people. We'll have to kind of see how, you know, things shake out and how this news continues to be disseminated and how these leaks continue to be, you know, dripping out to all of us here. But obviously his appearances in Dragon Gate are not what some would like it to be, certainly in his mind, for sure.
Well, imagine if you're someone, if you're a wrestler, you're a someone in the, maybe even in the Dragon Gate office, but if you aren't exactly clamoring for Nosawa Rongai to come in, and think about, you know, what Dragon Gate has done, that the continued development of really high-end wrestlers in record time, as far as from going to debut to being a featured wrestler, the booking where, you know, young wrestlers are elevated, they are a part of the mix, that constant stream of new guys coming in and becoming top wrestlers, and then you look at what Nosal Rangai has been involved with for the last 3 years or so in Pro Wrestling Noah, where it's all the 50 and over club. No new guys get over. Nobody who's even, you know, under the age of 35 is in a better place than they were 3 years ago when he came in as a booker. And then, you know, you're in Dragon Gate, you see him come in, and while, you know, you're not seeing him necessarily, to your point, taking over the booking completely, you're starting to see him have any influence over the direction of the product, whether it be matches, whether it be tournaments, or anything of the like. And I would imagine you're thinking, well, I don't want what happened there to happen here. And, you know, you'd be looking to get the word out in any way possible. So, I mean, I know from a fan standpoint, the last thing I want to see is anything remotely like the booking influence that Nosal Rangai had over the Noah product start to bleed its way into what Dragon Gate's doing, because, you know, we could do a much longer show, and we probably will at some point, about how in many of the top promotions in Japan, how dire the booking is right now, and how much it's, you know, it's all about booking old friends, which that's been wrestling booking forever. But over the last couple of years, particularly in the pandemic, it seems to have taken hold even more, whether it be an Osawa in Noah, you know, a Gato and a Dick Togo in New Japan, Tajiri to an extent in All Japan. You know, if I'm a guy in one of the few companies that hasn't been afflicted by that type of booking to a great degree, you know, I wouldn't be too thrilled about Nosawa's presence increasing on my shows.
No, and they need to do something to garner some share, bigger share of the marketplace, and some bigger share of the fans' eyes, and some, you know, generate some excitement and generate some talk. They need to do that. You know, the more people should know who Shun Skywalker is. Nobody, you know, more people
absolutely
should know who Jason Lee is. You know, do more people need to know who Peros Del Mal is? No. But, you know,
no,
but
considering every time a company tries to feature them, there's less people coming to the shows. So, yeah, I wouldn't say that's the case. I mean, I don't think Dragon Gate is any sort of desperate or dire straits.
No,
I mean,
no, not like
they're
that.
Behind
but they
in
they
Japan,
need it.
They're behind New Japan in sort of, you know, alternating 2-3, depending on how you look at business metrics with Stardom. You know, they're more well positioned as we start to come out of pandemic restrictions in Japan than some other companies are by far. But yes, I understand wanting to make waves, but man, I don't know that this is that there's any evidence that these are waves that are going to, you know, bring anything in positive. Certainly not going to bring in more fans. I don't think there's any evidence of that.
It's like John Tortorella getting fired and then immediately getting picked up by somebody.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's actually a really good point that a guy like Nosawa continuing to find featured work, not only as a wrestler, but as a guy who is having influence over the booking, if not outright being the booker. It is like the old boys network, the coaching carousel in the NHL. And I guess you could extend that out to general managers in that same league as well, where somehow the industry has convinced themselves that there's only 32 people in the world that can do that job. And they're just, they're just going to rotate in and out from city to city. There has to be someone with better ideas than Nosawa for a company like Noah or Dragon Gate to lean on. There has to be.
That was my olive branch Easter egg for all the olds out there that have been listening to us for a long time. But just to transition back to Noah for a second when it comes to Nosawa, him re-signing at all and staying in the mix there with Peros Del Mal, which is not, I'm not falling over shocked actually at that. You know, again, it didn't seem like, you know, he was removed, he was fired, however you want to put it, but it didn't seem like, it's not like he was embarrassed publicly on the way out the door or anything like that. So obviously the doors, you know, continued to stay open and he walked back in or crawled back in the doggy door or whatever it is.
It's also not like the booking changed in that very brief period of time, granted, just a few shows. But when you look at the direction and then the direction that was set during his absence, there was really no difference.
Well, that's what I was going to get to.
Stepping back, I mean, we still are going to see Kazuyuki Fujita heavily featured. We're still going to see well, we'll get to that later, what we're going to see with Keiji Muto going forward. But it's clear who the stars are, who the perceived stars are, regardless of the dismal attendance numbers. And it's not the guys, you know, that most people would like to see.
Well, that's what I was curious as to what you thought, you know, his role was going to be now just on the roster as he steps back into a place that doesn't look like it's going to change all that much. And even if it does, I can't see it changing that dramatically with Kendo Koshin being in charge for the reasons that you just mentioned there. Although, again, I am one of those people that I'm going to be very happy when Satoshi Kojima probably wins the GHC title. But with that said, I mean, what does it all really mean? What does it all really lead to at the end? Does it lead to Fujita again? You know, now we're talking about Muda possibly retiring. Does it matter? You know, and I mean, look, and that's a subject for another day, too, when it comes to the retirement of Keiji Muto. And I just want to say, for as negative as I have been on him being in the mix in Noah and having the matches he has and being in the position that he's in, you know, I never have to see Keiji Muto wrestle again. I love seeing the entrances. I love seeing him. But I don't want to see this guy who's only 60 years old and should have a lot of life left ahead of him be a cripple. And if the hip is that bad, please retire. Like, you've already given me way too much, and I'm good with that. So I'm going to be really actually happy about that. And it's not for the reasons that he'll be gone from the Noah scene. I just want to see this guy be able to live a healthy life if he is going to be retiring, which it seems like.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think, a relief on a lot of fronts would be the way I would describe it. If, you know, the announcement that he's going to be making at the Cyberfight Festival show on June 12th is, in fact, that he's retiring or starting a road to retirement, I'll believe it when I see it. You know, I'll believe that this is not just, you know, another storyline for him to go on another, you know, Keiji Muto redemption arc. There's all the talk, you know, that he, you know, for his 60th birthday, wants to win the national title, the GHC national title. And I still think I wouldn't be surprised if this is all setting up another Keiji Muto, you know, overcomes the odds and wins a title deal.
You want a curveball?
What's that?
You want a curveball?
Sure.
It's not like he hasn't come to StarCast before. Can you see him being FTR's partner against Flair in the Rock and Roll Express?
I mean, that's coming up soon. Like, that's in a couple of weeks, though, right?
Well, SummerSlam weekend, isn't it?
Is when is SummerSlam? This is August? Not a WWE podcast if you're a new listener.
Late July, early August, I think, is when it is. So
there's plenty of time then. I mean, if he is starting a retirement road, and that would be my guess, if he's announcing anything about a retirement, he's not going to be saying, I'm retiring here June 12th. You know, my last match was on May 21st. I think he will, if he is going to retire, it will be a protracted retirement tour. There's nothing about Keiji Muto, particularly as his career has gone on, there's nothing that about him that says, I'm going out quietly.
Oh, no.
I'm going out humbly.
He's picking up flowers everywhere he goes. It's like Derek Jeter and everything. Every arena he goes to, somebody's going to have a ceremony at the beginning. There's going to be an easel with a picture on it with an eternal flame. He's going to be getting flowers. He's going to be getting, there'll be a mascot in the ring in each city. It's going to be ridiculous.
Oh, yes. And like, to be clear, he is one of the most influential wrestlers of the modern era.
Damn
no
right.
One could argue against that. I never would. You never would.
Hell no.
If it, like, so many people of our age, there would not be.
He's an all-timer. You know, he's the reason some of us are here.
That's what I was getting at, that for so many people that are our age, he is the gateway. He's the reason. The great Muda in the late 80s and early 90s in the NWA and WCW is the guy that opened, you know, people's eyes in the United States to, you know, a Japanese wrestling beyond, Mr. Fuji throwing salt, for example, you know, that there was something more and that there was something extremely exciting out there. That said, there is no one in the world who is a bigger fan of Keiji Muto than Keiji Muto. And every single decision that he makes is based on that. And yeah, it's either going to go one of two ways. It's either going to be, you know, the start of a storyline to him getting one of the major championships, or it's going to be a very protracted retirement run, which, again, he deserves. Like, that's fine. But I think we hopefully are finally getting beyond the time where it's going to be, you know, Keiji Muto contending for the GHC heavyweight title. I will say, just note again, here in the main event at Ota War Gymnasium on May 21st, Kaito Kiyomiya did not pin Keiji Muto. He did not submit Keiji Muto. And I still am willing to take the bet with anyone that Kaito Kiyomiya will never get a direct pinfall or submission victory over Keiji Muto, no matter how many people have screamed at me for years that this is all some brilliant storyline to make Kaito Kiyomiya the biggest star in Japanese wrestling by, you know, beating a six-year-old Keiji Muto.
We danced this dance already with him in major titles. I hope it's not that. I really hope it's not that. I hope it's a retirement tour, and I hope he wins everywhere he goes as long as he puts Kiyomiya and Nakajima over. And I know you don't think that he will. He probably won't, but he should. You know, he can win everywhere else. He can do whatever he wants. He can even beat one of those guys again in a tag match in another promotion if they want to go along and, you know, they come to New Japan and you do some eight-man or some whatever it is that you want to do wherever Muto's doing his thing on that day. But it's he call me crazy. Yeah, he should put Kiyomiya over because, look, there
absolutely
are those people that
should. No one would call you crazy for saying that he should.
If he still
some
is
people, including the person on the other end of this internet connection, would call you crazy for thinking he will.
Well, and that's the name Keiji Muto should still be a thing to pin, and Kiyomiya should. Hey, everything that somebody tried to argue against you, you know, knowing that the end is near here for Muto, knowing what they've done already, knowing how Kiyomiya hasn't gotten that win, everything anybody ever wanted to say about Muto and his influence and his what he was going to do for that company, COVID aside and all that, all that goes out the window if he doesn't actually lay down for him, because what good was it then?
Well, what it was good for was the only intention from the beginning, which is, this is somewhat rehashing what older listeners have heard, but it's worth bringing up for people who are newer listeners or may not be as familiar. This entire regime of Pro Wrestling Noah that has been booked and may still be being booked by Nosawa Rangai is a Nosawa Rangai fantasy camp. He's booking the guys that are either his friends, his heroes, the guys he's fans of. And nothing that's happening in Pro Wrestling Noah, nothing that has happened for the last 3 years, is about elevating Katsuhiko Nakajima, or is about elevating Kaito Kiyomiya, or about making them by having them beat the likes of a Keiji Muto or a Kaz Fujita. It is the story that's being told is the story of Keiji Muto, the story of Kazuyuki Fujita, and guys like Kiyomiya and Nakajima are there to make those guys look good. As ridiculous and backwards of a booking philosophy as that is, that's the scenario and that's the lens and the prism that I think all of this needs to be looked through.
You remember when Taiji Ishimori was in Noah?
Yes.
He's not anymore. He's in New Japan now in the Best of the Super Juniors. How's that for a transition?
That is a professional transition with 16 years of experience on this podcast backing it up.
By the way, this is also where we'll insert the ad read that'll be coming up for you. That's how that transition goes. And it's like, hey, you know, did we tell you about, you know, subscribing to WrestlingObserver.com for $12.99 a month? Did we do that? Did we talk to you about one of these products that we're going to be pitching to you that you need, like some earbuds or some performance-enhancing pills? We're going to have all that stuff, and it's going to be an ad read that we're going to put right here one day.
There you go. Placeholder. I like it. Good job, Mike.
Thank you.
Yes, with that, let's pivot to the Best of the Super Junior Tournament, because as I mentioned at the top of the show, it's both similar to pre-COVID Best of the Super Junior and very different from the past few years, as thankfully we have representatives from many different companies involved, mixing it up, sparing us from only the bone dry overdone matches of the past few years. We're still not all the way there. Obviously, in Japan, COVID restrictions not allowing for fans to cheer. We're starting to see a bit of cracks in that, whether that be the the Nomads Joshi show that took place a few days ago that had some cheering allowed, or the talk even from up top with New Japan that maybe by June there may be social distance sections at the shows that people are allowed to cheer from, and then the rest of the building, people still can't cheer. I don't know exactly how that would work, but that's something that New Japan president Obari did talk about earlier today in an interview. So maybe we'll have some hybrid situation by the time that June 3rd and the Best of the Super Junior finals roll around. But what we have had, if nothing else, is we've had fresh matches in this first week of the tournament.
I hope this doesn't sound like a backhand compliment, because I don't mean it to be at all. But, like, this is the best collection of 3 to 3.5 star good to very good matches
yes.
that you can imagine. And I know the G1, when that comes, it's going to be a much bigger explosion onto the scene because of the names and all that sort of stuff. And I had a feeling that the Best of the Super Juniors was going to start exactly in the way that it did. Kind of quieter. You got guys who are in Japan for the first time. You have guys who are in Japan for the first time in a long time. Guys who are working for New Japan proper for the first time. Guys facing off against opponents who they've never seen before, never faced off against before. So there was a lot where it was like I had a feeling that they were slowly going to build to something. And I think other than a couple of cases that we're going to end up getting into that were excellent, and then a couple cases that were bad, for the most part, almost every single match on this show can be considered good. The story that is told can be considered good. The performances can be considered very solid and very good. So there's not a lot of things that I think people need to really go out of their way for, but if you're listening to this show and you are a big wrestling fan, you know, matches like Yo against Clark Connors, while you're not going to, you know, the wheel is not being reinvented, and if you don't see it, you know, you're not going to go to your grave regretting it. But, you know, if you do have the time, like, a lot of these matches on these shows have been very enjoyable.
Yeah, it's, you know, to your point, a collection of, you know, 3 to 3.5 star matches. When I'm in my notes app on my iPhone as I'm watching wrestling, I'm not a star ratings guy, but I'm a, you know, I'm a good or good exclamation point or very good exclamation point or great. So that's kind of my rating system in my head and in my notes. And these have all kind of been in that very good to a few with a very good exclamation point. I think a lot of it is by design, though, too. It's when you look at these shows, really, it's been 8 to 15-minute matches. Even the main events, you look at the opening night, 16:15, second night, 13:45, third night, 17:05 for the main event, 16:07, another one at 13:45. The most recent show, which I actually thought, even though it was a small, you know, small building, small town show, was actually the best so far, May 22nd, that main event, 15 minutes and 44 seconds. So by design, we're not necessarily seeing any blowaway matches. I think that's going to change, particularly over these next 3 days, later in the week at Corican Hall. But to your point, I guess let's get the negative out of the way first. There's a few things, one which is very much expected, sadly, at this point, and one which I, you know, it may be not as expected in terms of just being really, really bad, and they're both in the A block show. That's we'll start there. That's one that's not surprising. Everything that you've seen, if you're a hardcore New Japan fan, or let's say you are a New Japan fan who you know, has just been turned off by the extreme level of interference in, you know, show evil Dick Togo matches, and let's say you haven't watched show at all yet this year, it's everything you hate and more. In these matches, it's the same mind-numbing ref bumps, distractions. He's got the wrench wrapped in the shirt. No one is going to have their best performance in this tournament against Show, whether it's Francesco Akira debuting in New Japan on the opening night, Alex Zane making his New Japan proper debut on the second night, Clark Connors having to wrestle Show on the third night of A-block action. He's a bit like a moving chicane in this tournament.
And the frustrating part of that is the fact that because you know he can go, and when there is not all the nonsense and everything is gelling with the person that he's working with, you see why you like this guy so much, and then you get really frustrated when he goes to all the gimmicks and the ref bumps and the ref abuse and the all that nonsense. And it could be a lot worse. I mean, junior heavyweight, so it's been a it's been more of a junior version of it. But I mean, it's still so over the top, and it's just so tired. And you know, when he's having a one in a, you know, barely a 2-star match with Clark Connors, because that's got nothing to do with the work that they're doing, and it's got everything to doing with all the BS on the side. You know, that's really frustrating. But as you mentioned, that's to be expected because of the House of Torture deal and all that sort of stuff, where it is. And I have not been as down as you have on all of his matches, but man, Ryusuke Taguchi, and I understand somebody, you know, the veteran kind of playing the fool in this tournament, okay, that's fine, but man, he got off to a bad start and put some bad taste in my mouth with that Hiromu match first, and he's gotten better since then, but this has not been a good tournament for Taguchi when you already got all that other nonsense happening on, you know, taking place in the same bracket going on with House of Torture. It makes this comedy, when it doesn't click, even worse.
Yeah, that match with Hiromu Takahashi on the opening night was brutal. Not just the comedy itself, it just didn't land. They're leaning in so hard into the Taguchi has his pants pulled down, he pulls his pants down. You've got the cringeworthy commentary from Kevin Kelly and Chris Charlton, who are usually spot on fantastic, but Taguchi matches just bring out the absolute worst in both of them. And then beyond that, like, the actual in-ring action in that match was just so far off both guys' normal level. They just didn't click, which was surprising. It's not like they are strangers to wrestling each other, but not a very good match. Taguchi, he did have his last match against Francesco Akira largely steered clear of that, and shockingly was much better. But still, yeah, it's having those two things going on in the same block make for some rough watches. Going back to show, though, I think it's a complaint not just at the show. It's a complaint with Evil. It's a complaint when Jay White is in Japan. My issue isn't even as much that, you know, you've got the interference, you've got the ref bumps. I hate it, but it's okay, or it's more tolerable if you do it sometimes. The fact that in every single show match or in every single Evil match, there is some sort of ref bump, weapon shot, attempted ref bump, attempted weapon shot. What it leads me as a viewer to feel is there's no reason to watch the first, whatever, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18, 20 minutes of the match until that point to where the attempted ref bump or attempted weapon shot happens. There's no reason to watch any of the action before that, because you know there is zero chance of a finish in the match happening until that whole deal starts. It just, you know, I can say with 100% certainty that if I was not doing this podcast and if I was not writing Three Count Fall every week, that I would not be watching these show matches. I would be fast forwarding, skimming to the end, and then watching the last minute after whatever happens, because otherwise all the action before, like I said, is just it's totally meaningless. You know, it's not going to lead to the finish.
It's very WWE, because that's how you start conditioning your fans to react. And it's just one of those things that naturally, it absolutely happens, that the psychology of a fan, it changes. And unfortunately, well, again, Kevin Kelly keeps talking about it. You know, when the fans come back, okay. Yeah. When the fans come back, we'll see how they respond to all of this stuff. And I will be more interested to see how New Japan takes any of their reactions and how they are spun to the fans really loving all of this House of Torture stuff and Bullet Club stuff and all that other stuff. We'll see.
Well, that's the other thing, that as crowd reactions come back, it's going to take away a lot of the excuses we've seen from bookers and from promoters, from some of these companies in Japan, where it's, well, yeah, our numbers are way down because of the pandemic. Our numbers are, you know, way down because of X, Y, and Z. When all that, you know, when full capacity is allowed, you know, which is in most cities already there, and when crowd cheering starts to be allowed, you're not going to have as much of the excuses. And also, as we've talked about before, those excuses aren't even all that valid because Stardom exists and they're drawing bigger crowds to more shows than they ever have before. And that blows the whole completely into the excuse of, well, it's impossible to maintain or grow under the current conditions. So it will be very interesting. We should note, though, that like attendance has been solid to very good, depending on the city. I mean, you look at the opening night in Nagoya, they sold that building out. And, you know, other companies in New Japan as well, other companies have run shows there and not done well at all in recent months. I've talked about ad nauseum. Go back to a couple months ago when Kazuyuki Fujita, I believe it's the show where he won the GHC Heavyweight Championship from Katsuhiko Nakajima, and they only drew like 600 fans. So, you know, it's an impressive number there. Sendai was good, but not great. It kind of matched their best pandemic number in Sendai Sun Plaza Hall. Some of these smaller cities, they've done pretty well. Omori, it's a big arena that they only sold the floor for, but they jam packed the floor, 1700 fans. The show in Akita, which did seem to have socially distanced seating, at least in the upper, the small balcony, it looked pretty full for what they sold. So I'll actually be really interested to see how they do coming up for three nights at Korakuen, because as we've talked about, they've kind of not necessarily for their big shows, but by running so many times at Korakuen during the pandemic, they've kind of killed that market a little bit.
Yeah, and it's what's the main event on the last Korakuen show? Is it going to be Hiromu and Sho? It probably will be. But, you know, that leads to, oh, God, what are we going to have in the main event of that show when it happens? So,
well, that will probably draw very well, though, because if you recall, Hiromu versus Evil a couple months ago popped, I believe, their first over 1,000 attendance at Korakuen during the pandemic. So it'll be interesting. I mean, at Korakuen these next three shows on the 24th, 25th, and 26th. They are 10-match shows, all block action. We've had either A block or B block, and then, you know, preview tags on each show. Now we're into the meat of the tournament where it's all block action and, you know, some pretty big matches. We've got Desperado and El Lindemann looks to be the main event on the 24th. Hiromu, Takahashi, and Yo looks to most likely be the main event on the 25th. And then, like you said, either Hiromu and Sho or Eagles and Phantasmo, most likely the main event on the 26th.
And that's the thing. If it's going to be Yo and Hiromu, which makes complete sense to be the main event on that second night, then do you give Hiromu back-to-back main events? I would, but they may not have that mentality where it is going to be Robbie Eagles and El Phantasmo, and, you know, good. It would make, you know, that makes actually some sense to do. Well, I mean, you're going to have a rapt audience there anyway. They're two of your foreigners that, you know, Eagles is a former IWGP Junior Heavyweight Champion. You know, LP is a main part of that division, and, you know, going forward, he's not going anywhere. So it would make complete sense to do that. So we'll see.
You'd also have to think that if Sho's winning, that's most likely going to be the semi-main.
Yeah.
You know, and that will probably be a tell as to who will win that match.
Especially with some bullshit. If it's going to be a bunch of bullshit, at least at the end, we're going to get Eagles and Phantasmo. I know LP is one of those guys that, you know, some people stomach his bullshit more than others because he's got that, you know, look, he's a troll. And it's like the Young Bucks. He does stuff because he knows it's going to get a reaction, whether good or bad, but that's what his character is. That's what he does. And even with that, I think he and Robbie Eagles can put on a match if there is going to be BS at the end of that and there's going to be a bunch of House of Torture nonsense being involved with Hiromu that ends up costing Hiromu the match. To have a banger between those two close the show, probably a good idea.
Yeah, yeah, I would prefer that for sure. As far as what we've seen so far, throughout the tournament, and that obviously is all the matches we watch them, that's why we do the podcast, but things that sort of stand out or that you really need to watch, I look at that first night and I don't think Ace Austin defeating Clark Connors, Alex Zane defeating Yoshinobu Kanemaru, we talked about Francesco Akira and Sho being what it was. Francesco Akira getting the win there. The Hiromu Taguchi match, Ishimori and Yo. I don't really think there's anything on that first show that anyone needs to go out of their way and watch. Really, some of the undercard stuff. I thought the opener, the Tenzan Tiger Mask, Robbie Eagles and Master Wato against Wheeler Yuta and the three young lions, Nakashima, Fujita, and Oiwa. I thought that was the best match on the show.
Well, and they have been. It should be noted, too, because during times like this, it is very, very easy to just watch the tournament matches to try to shave time off of things. But much like in the case of Alex Zane, much like in several cases, some of the things that are taking place on these undercards are impacting what is taking place inside the tournament as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Leading into a lot of times, you've got a couple guys on each side that will then be wrestling each other in a tournament match the next night. The second night, Doki and L. Lindemann, I thought was very good, under 10 minutes, and really, in some ways, a surprising result in that L. Lindemann, the late G-Rex champion, who was going to be defending his title the very next night on the 18th against Shigehiro Irie, what I thought was going to happen in this tournament ended up being completely wrong as far as Lindemann is concerned. I thought he would beat Doki here. He would then lose the G-Rex title to Irie, then opening him up to be able to lose more matches throughout the tournament without it looking like, you know, Glate's champion is just losing to everybody. That's not what happened here, though. Doki with the suplex de la Luna getting the victory on Lindemann. I really enjoyed Robbie Eagles and Wheeler Yuta. And then obviously Desperado and Teton in the main event was very good. But Eagles Yuta, just a really solid, you know, 10, 11 minute match.
Yeah, it's Robbie Eagles. And there's been so many good performances. He doesn't even fit in my top six of guys that I kind of wanted to focus on. But Desperado, Teton, and TJ Perkins, and then Ace Austin, Lindemann, and LP, all in their own ways, take Hiromu out of the mix. I think they've had probably the best tournament so far. And for Desperado, it started on that second night in that main event with Teton. And I think it's arguable that he is the MVP of this thing.
Oh, and he absolutely is.
He may not be
the MVP of the tournament. I think he clearly has become the best junior heavyweight in New Japan. And,
yeah,
and that includes Hiromu Takahashi. Just in terms of the variety of his matches, I've loved throughout this tournament so far. The different ways that he's gotten into hitting the Pinche Loco for the finish. But yeah, the match with Teton was great. The match, the main event on the 19th, Desperado defeating TJP, was one of the best matches of the tournament as well. Wheeler Yuta on the most recent show on the 22nd for Desperado. Good stuff as well. And it should be noted, if you watch that match and you saw Desperado's reaction afterwards, shaking Wheeler Yuta's hand and just the way he talked in the post-match, Desperado seemed to be legitimately impressed with Wheeler Yuta as an opponent.
Desperado, Doki, and Ace Austin are the standouts on working with others, and Teton to a certain degree too.
Yeah,
but
I just have to jump in because I don't see it as much with Ace Austin as you and a lot of other people do. Like, I think he's been fine, but I don't think he's, and again, he's super young and he hasn't worked Japan yet, but I don't think he's been anywhere near the level of a guy like Desperado or even a guy like Doki in this tournament.
Oh no.
Teton for that matter. Like, he shows a ton of potential, but I think there's a long way to go before I would even mention him in the same name as the top three or four guys here.
Oh, I agree with you. I absolutely 100% agree with you, but I think, you know, in like Francesco Akira, obviously a lot more experience and a lot more, you know, worldly travel and everything, you know, he stands out more too. But I think, you know, you take him and I think, you know, him and Alex Zane, and I guess you could put Wheeler Yuta into that mix too. But like, you take guys who it's like, okay, let's see how when they travel over what it's going to look like. And I think out of, you know, TJ and Yuta is a special, again, he's been around a long time because of his style. You know, he's going to be great with everybody, and I think we're seeing that, how good of a fit he could be over there, you know, if he's going to be in the mix on a regular basis. But I think when it comes to like Zane and Austin, I see where Austin, I think, is working better, you know, with newer people that he has never come in contact with. And I think he's a lot more, he's coming across as a lot more comfortable. And maybe I'm just, you know, I don't see him that much in Impact. So maybe I'm a little extra impressed, you know, seeing him. But I think he has certainly, I think, carved his niche really well. And I think, you know, he's one of those guys, like, once this is over, you know, there's a lot of people that want to go to Japan, but he's a guy that I think his phone's going to be ringing again.
No, I agree. I mean, I'm not saying he hasn't been impressive. I just think people need to pump the brakes a little bit.
Oh, see, yeah, and I haven't seen that amount of love for him. It's like TNA Mecca.
No, I think he's been very good. I will say that I thought Alex Zane got off to a bit of a slow start, but if you haven't seen his match with Ishimori, which is the main event on the 21st, it's worth watching. It's also, you can just see how good Taiji Ishimori is, maybe compared to some of Alex Zane's other opponents so far in the tournament, because he, and it might just be the way the styles mesh too, but everything Zane did and sort of the interplay throughout the match just seemed to work so much better with Ishimori, and Zane came out, I thought, looking a lot better than he did early on in the tournament. Also wanted to touch on, because you mentioned Francesco Akira, by far, and this, again, not necessarily a shock, but by far his best performance in the tournament so far was the main event in Sendai against Hiromu. It ended before it could hit great territory, but I thought from Akira, when you factor in the fact that he's in a new promotion, he's wrestling as sort of a heel or at least heel-ish character compared to the, you know, sort of really white bread underdog babyface that he was in All Japan. And he has probably like 60 to 70% new moveset. You know, and he's having to figure that all out on the fly in the Best of the Super Junior tournament. I thought this was a really impressive performance from him. He gets beat with the time bomb too, by Hiromu in that main event on the 21st. But I'm really looking forward to seeing kind of how Akira continues to progress throughout the tournament. Also wanted to mention
my
that...
My God, he had Taguchi's best match, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah, well, yeah, there you go. That's a feather in his cap as well. This has also been one of those tournaments where you kind of remember, oh, yeah, Bushi's actually pretty good. He's had a few under the radar, really solid matches. I loved his match with Robbie Eagles on the 19th. He had a better match than I think most have with Master Wato on the 22nd. So, you know, he's one of those guys that you don't like think about like, oh yeah, Bushi's in the tournament. Awesome. But, you know, for a guy that is most of the year just in, you know, relatively meaningless, you know, 6 and 8 man tags, he hasn't looked bad here.
It's all those old pros. Desperado, Bushi, Taiji Ishimori. I mean, they can all go. And this is, you can't replace Hiromu. I know this. Get him out of there. He needs to be in the heavyweight division. And I know there's stories that they still could want to tell with him and all that. So I get it, but like, the division obviously needs to try to replace him and try to crown the next Hiromu and find that person.
But they have Desperado. The ascent of Desperado over the last couple of years has made it possible to at least go to more of an open weight, if not full-fledged heavyweight run for Hiromu. And we've talked about it before that with so few new stories available to be told, you know, everyone that's going for the heavyweight title is someone who's already held it. You know, the Bullet Club, we've talked ad nauseum about how it's just regurgitating the same stories with slightly different characters. Hiromu going legitimately for the IWGP World Heavyweight title and winning it is by far the freshest story they could tell. And it's not like the guy's not over enough to be able to pull it off.
Absolutely. And there's sub-stories you could tell with Naito, whether they be friction or friendship or whatever. I mean, there's so many things you can do in that direction. And what I was gonna get to is just because Hiromu, he's special, he's generational. You know, when he came up with Dragon, with Lee, and all, with everything that happened as he was coming up, and the type of character and person he was in time and place, he's perfect. And you can't replicate that, but you got to try to find that next person. And because you're so stacked, you have a good group of foreigners who are already there, like your Eagles, like your LPs. You have guys who are you can always use on the bench and in America who can now travel over. You have guys like Titan who you can remember, hey, we can use these guys and bring them in. And with the core that you already have, it's going to buy you the time. It's why I was a proponent of Robbie Eagles having the IWGP Junior Heavyweight title when he did. Because at the moment and in the time, like, he needs to, look, if he needs to have another run later to be, like, a remembered IWGP Junior Heavyweight Champion. But when at the time that they did it, it was a smart move because why not then? It didn't hurt anything. It only helped him. It was good timing. And now when you're trying to find that next Hiromu, and you should have them with show, but, you know, things are what they are, but whatever. Look, it can buy you time. So the faster you can get Hiromu up, the better they're going to be, and the more they can concentrate on these other guys, especially because, again, Desperado, I don't know if people outside of the bubble really realize how great he is and how consistent he is and how...
And how, like, popular he is.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a hot deal in a hot group, and you see the other members, and you forget how strong he is.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing is you're running down kind of the lay of the land of the junior heavyweight division, and the ability to take Hiromu Takahashi to heavyweight. I just always go back to how much New Japan really, really needed Hirai Kawato, that being Master Wato, to hit and be a top tier junior heavyweight that could lead the division. When you go back to as a very young lion, both in terms of experience and age, just, you know, he seemed like a guy who was poised to be that guy. And while we've seen very incremental improvement in the couple of years that he's been back from his rather star-crossed excursion, he's nowhere near ready to carry the division as a singles wrestler. And man, that's a guy they needed to hit. You know, you think about, you know, pro sports analogy, you get a first round pick and you're doing a rebuild and you really, really need that guy. You know, you draft first, second, third overall, and you need that guy to be a top player. And he just kind of instead is, you know, in hockey parlance, it's like a solid third liner. It's like, oh, well, yeah, it's so good that you have him on the team, but he's not what you needed him to be. That's kind of where Master Wato is right now and what that means for New Japan.
Yeah, I mean, football terms, you know, look, he wasn't a first or a second-round draft choice, but he was a guy that they were going to send over a third and a fourth, and those are the guys you need to hit. Like, you need to hit those third-round draft picks, and he was a guy, okay, we're going to bring him back over. And, you know, we don't think he's going to be Hiromu, but we are going to need this guy to play, you know, punch above his weight. And unfortunately, he hasn't. You know, Okan came back, and he did. Evil came back and he did, you know, for a significant period of time before, you know, they, you know, we got into modern Evil. But, you know, Wato came back and we've swung and we've missed. And that's just the way that goes. And they're going to try to, they need to find somebody else to fill that void. And will it be, look, they got plenty of foreigners who can fill it for a while, but somebody's going to have to step up who is a native, and they're going to have to hit on a character, hit on a person that's going to take it and run with it.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
I'm not sold on Yo being that guy. You know,
I
don't.
A perfectly rock solid professional wrestler, and he's another guy who definitely resonates more with the core Japanese fan base than he does with the American fan base. But he's a guy who, you know, you're happy to have him on your roster, but if you're depending on him to be a real mover in any way, there's problems, and, you know, and that's sort of, you know, that's sort of where they're at. One company that is in the exact opposite position, it is an abundance of riches, an embarrassment of riches, maybe the deepest roster of any company in the world, outside of, I guess you could say, AEW. I would say definitely the deepest roster of any company in Japan in terms of, you know, current, future, and everything in between stars is Stardom. And they have their next show, their next big pay-per-view coming up at the Ota War Gymnasium on May 28th. Pretty much every title on the line, most big matches happening here as far as we look at the schedule. It's kind of a weird show in that the main event is Shuri making another defense of the World of Stardom title, the Red Belt, against not Suzu Suzuki from Prominence, but Risa Sera of Prominence, which will... you know, it will be good. I don't think it's going to be great. I don't think it's going to, we're going to look back on Shuri's title reign and say, this is the best match of the reign by any stretch. To me, the true main event of the show is the white belt match, the Wonder of Stardom title, semi-main event, Saya Kamatani defending her title after a series of successful defenses against the Cinderella tournament winner, sort of the person that has the most momentum, both in terms of storyline and fan reaction right now in Stardom, that being Mirai.
How happy does that make you as I take my microphone off of mute?
I am thrilled.
20 years of doing this show, still don't get the technology right.
If you, obviously, if you follow me on Twitter at Adam of the Band, if you've been listening to this podcast, if you've been reading the Three Count Fall newsletter, adamsummers.substack.com, I've been talking for months, or actually years, about Mirai, going back to when she was Mirai Mayumi in Tokyo Joshi Pro, and saying how, much like Natsupoi before her, that this was someone who was just kind of there on the card in Tokyo Joshi Pro that had the potential to be a true, legitimate main event wrestler and would improve dramatically when in a company that is filled with other, you know, great wrestlers. It's not a slight on Tokyo Joshi Pro. You know, you've got Yamashita, you've got Sakazaki, you've got a core of people there, but, you know, it's nowhere near the depth up and down the card that Stardom has. And Mirai has just absolutely taken the ball and ran with it. She had the match with Shuri for the red belt a few months ago, joined the God's Eye group led by Shuri, and then just, you know, went on that run in the Cinderella tournament and, you know, kind of as that was going along, became one of the most popular wrestlers in the company. And now we're in a, you know, we have a match where maybe for the first time in the past several months, it feels like it's a challenger that Saya Kamatani could actually lose to. I don't expect that. This year seems to be all about making Saya Kamatani, you know, one of the faces of the company. And I don't know that they're necessarily ready for this title reign to end. But, you know, given the momentum that Mirai has, you could very easily see that happening as well.
Well, her ice ribbon friend, who's a better friend to Julia, that's the match that I'm most interested in to see if, you know, Thekla and Azumi.
High-speed title.
I'm fascinated. Look, it took me a little longer than certainly you to warm up to Thekla. I was not. I know she jumped over and people were doing, you know, backflips over it. And it's like, okay, you know, let's see how, because I didn't have that much. I didn't watch her that much. But as time has gone on, I've liked her more and more. The match with Iwatani, I thought was, you know, again, obviously it's Mayu Iwatani too, but, you know, was really good. And I'm really interested to see how this match is going to play. And I like the dynamic of the matchup with the two against each other.
Particularly, you know, in that high-speed environment where we've talked about before, Azumi is, you know, she's the best in the world right
yes.
now at wrestling that style. Just out of this world in terms of just the speed, the execution, being able to string moves together, the athleticism, and doing it all so effortlessly. There's a very high bar for any match, whether it be a high-speed title match or anything else. A high bar for anything to reach the levels of Azumi versus Starlight Kid from several months ago, the latest installment of their long-running rivalry. I don't know that this will get there, but I'm looking forward to it as well. Particularly given that Thekla has looked great in tag team matches, eight-man, six-man tag team matches, and she did have a very good performance against Mayu Iwatani, but it'll be interesting to see her in another, you know, high profile big singles match and see how that goes.
Have they had any, now did I miss it? Have they had any lead up to this whatsoever? Because I don't know, you know, other than I'm sure a random eight woman or something like that, how much have they even crossed paths?
Yeah, no, they crossed paths in a match leading to Thekla making the challenge and getting the shot. But yeah, I mean, there hasn't been a ton of interaction between them. Given her style, I think it'll work perfectly fine. I mean, you have to be quick to keep up with Azumi. I think it'll I think it'll work
just,
fine.
It's just unique. That stands out. That is very like a lot more than, let's say, Mayu and Fukikin death. You know what I'm saying?
That's just it's an amusing way of getting into the match where
it's a night off.
Saki Kashima had defeated Mayu Iwatani, I believe it was last month. It was like 17 seconds. It was ridiculously quick. But the stipulation for the title is that it has to be defended against a foreigner. And Saki Kashima, not a foreigner. Well, she nominated Fukigen Death under the supposition that Fukigen Death is, in fact, an alien.
Well,
that she is not from this planet, and Mayu Iwatani, being Mayu Iwatani, accepted this explanation and therefore took the match. So it'll be fun. It'll be quick.
When are we getting Mayu and Tony Storm? Come on, please.
Well, I think, yeah, that's kind of what everyone's waiting to see is there a chance that even though Stardom has a show on June 26th, will they send Mayu Iwatani to Forbidden Door and have her defend the SWA world title against someone from AEW? Fingers crossed, as someone who'll be attending that show live, that it will happen. As far as other major matches on this show, from a sort of garnering headline standpoint, the biggest match on this show happens halfway through the card, as it's Tam Nakano teaming with Kairi, the former Kairi Sane, Kairi Hojo, in Kairi's return match since her last return a couple months ago to Stardom, recovering from her ear injury. And they take on the team, the new leader of Queen's Quest, Utami Hayashishita, and the super rookie, Miyu Amasaki. We are all wondering when we'd see Kairi next in Stardom, you know, how long term this was or wasn't going to be. And we have her answer. She's on a big show here coming up over the weekend.
19 years old, talking trash, Miyu Amasaki, right? So this is the most interesting thing is, look, with all the women she's working with, it's not like, you know, she's not going to be fine, but what a position to be in. You know, and again, Tam and Kairi together as a team, you know, I was wondering, you know, at first it's like it's a perfect combination for both of them. Like, again, it gives Tam something to do, not in the title picture or anything like that. And she's the perfect teammate for Kairi.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm sure it'll lead to a singles match between them at some point. I'm also desperately looking forward to the upcoming Tam Nakano Natsupoi match, which it's not on the May 28th show, and there will be no title on the line when it happens. But whenever that happens, if you have not watched that, their match, I guess it would have been from last year? It was early last year. That was in the very, very high on my list of matches of the year. Go back and watch it on Stardom World. I'll do some research here. You talk. I'm going to find the date because people deserve to know exactly when that match was so they can go back and watch it.
A professional you are, and as you go ahead and look for that, I will run down a couple other matches that are going to be on this card, including the Artist of
Stardom. I have it. It is April 4th, 2021. How dare I forget?
How fast?
The date of maybe my match of the year, all of 2021.
Well, as I was saying, the Artist of Stardom title match, Maika, Himeka, and Natsupoi against Momo Watanabe, Starlight Kid, and Saki Kashima. So really not a whole lot to add there. I assume Donna Del Mondo is going to hold on to those belts.
Yeah, probably hold on, continue their record-setting run. The more interesting match to me is the Goddesses of Stardom tag team title match with Hazuki and Koguma defending against Julia and Mai Sakurai, of all people, who has continued to slowly improve. You talk about taking someone out of a stable they didn't really fit in, having her in the Cosmic Angels group and then putting her in Donna Del Mondo. It's done wonders for her as a wrestler. And she had her biggest win to date in Stardom, pinning Koguma in a 6 or 8 man tag match, leading to her being able to be Julia's partner and get this tag title shot. I'm sure they will lose, and I'm sure it will be Sakurai that will be pinned. But it's another, you know, sort of good step for her along the way. You know, Stardom heads through the spring and into the 5-star Grand Prix.
Well, on the surface, Cosmic Angels made sense at first, but
yeah, it did. But it was very quickly clear that, you know, that it didn't seem like that was a group that she was going to improve greatly in. You know,
there's
whereas
a lot to
on the
learn,
other end,
my
Waka
friend
Tsukiyama, who has yet to win in Stardom, and it's they've done it so well in that she's so much more over because she always comes up just short and loses than if she had just won a few matches here or there.
She's much more on the Barry Horowitz / Jack Hart scale than the Mike Boyette scale. I'll give her that. That's
she's the gambler of Stardom, I guess you could say. She'll have opportunities though to get wins because there's coming up sort of a lead in into the 5-star Grand Prix. You've got a bunch of wrestlers. You've got Miyu Amasaki, Waka Tsukiyama, Lady C, Ruaka, Ami Sarai, Momo Kogo, Hina, a bunch of people, Saida as well, in this sort of mini league tournament to get a spot in the actual 5-star Grand Prix. So we'll see if Tsukiyama goes undefeated throughout that entire mini tournament as well, or if she actually gets her first win there.
And there's a lot of projects on that board that you just mentioned right there, but it shows you the depth that they have with some of the young people that they have and some people that they want to develop, and not all those people are going to work themselves out. I'm more bullish on some than others. You know, Lady C, I don't know. We'll have to see moving forward, but, you know, they are loaded up, and I am a little upset, you know, Mei Sakurai, you know, leaving Cosmic, as if, how dare you try to intimate, if that's a word, if I didn't just make that one up, that Mina Shirakawa didn't have much to offer teaching-wise to Mei Sakurai. My God, have you seen her cut promos?
I've been saying for the better part of a year how much Shirakawa has improved. It just didn't seem like a fit. They were all dancing out there, and it just didn't seem... it didn't seem like Sakurai's heart was in being a part of that group. So... all's well that ends well.
Sakurai, Sayaka, and Shirakawa are still my tag team champions.
Yes, they are. I don't think you're going to ever find two better characters to have paired together than those two. It's just, and then obviously with Tam Nakano as well. It's a perfect group as is. From a character and storyline standpoint. So a ton of stuff going on in Stardom. Plenty of things going on.
This is how Tam needed another adult
as well.
Tam needed another adult to come to the room.
The King of Gate tournament is ongoing. I have to at least briefly mention for people who have not yet watched All Japan. I think has been on fire this year under the radar from an in-ring standpoint. And there are two shows on the 14th and 15th. Show on the 15th with Kento Miyahara successfully defending against Yuma Aoyagi. That's, you know, getting more of the talk, and rightfully so. It was a great match. But go and watch, if you subscribe to AJPW.TV, All Japan streaming service, and you have not yet watched kind of the preview tag leading into that the night before on May 14th with Kento Miyahara and Rising Hayato against Yuma and Atsuki Aoyagi, do yourself a favor and watch that. I thought that was even better than the Triple Crown match the night before. To me, that it's right there with, as far as tag team match of the year, with Briscoe's FTR, with the match from the early May Big Japan show with Daichi Hashimoto and Hideyoshi Kamatani taking on Takuya Nomura and Fuminori Abe. It is top tier stuff and definitely worth your time.
I got to do I really ought to look this up. Has anyone had more in this era, more half-hour plus matches, title matches than Miyahara?
Probably not. I mean, maybe Okada, but it feels like Miyahara has not had as long away from you know, the main title, that being the Triple Crown in All Japan. He's not as much time away from the main championship in his promotion as Okada has. Plus, he's had some lengthy tag title matches as well.
Yeah, it's Okada's about the only one I could think of. But like with Miyahara, it's like, and it's not a bad look. It's one of those things that I have argued plenty of times with Miyahara that a match could have been shorter, but the end result is always it's always still really good to great. That it's you can't pick the nits. You know, again, you can watch it and go, man, you could have shaved some time off of that. But there's never any regret when you leave a Miyahara match. And that's, you know, again, it's like Dragon Gate needing to try to claw and figure out a way to, you know, kind of get, you know, their stars more shoved down everybody's throat. And All Japan in that same situation with Kento Miyahara, too, where it's just, you know, it's just unfortunately there's only so much time for a lot of people and there's only so much, you know, All Japan can do to try to, you know, shine a big light on their promotion. And he's one of those guys that just unfortunately gets lost in the mix. He's one of those guys I wish could come over and have that Konosuke Takeshita moment where people can finally see that this guy who's been over there and been so great for so long, hey, you know, get some new eyes on him. Maybe he makes a couple of new fans and more people get behind him.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. And I think as much, if not more, the key for All Japan is getting someone else up to the level of Kento Miyahara. And hopefully they're getting there. They're getting close with Yuma Aoyagi over the course of those two matches, him winning the Champion Carnival tournament this year as well. Maybe, and if you haven't watched them, you might scoff at this, but just trust me. You know, watch the Champion Carnival final. Watch the matches I just talked about. Yuma Aoyagi may be the best big match wrestler in the world right now, at least in Japan. They need to get someone to at least be a legitimate 1A to Miyahara, a guy that, you know, they need someone else so that if Miyahara isn't in the main event, they don't draw half of what they would if Miyahara was in the main event. And so hopefully they're on that road with Miyahara.
By the next show, I'm going to come up with a name, a foreigner from America that can actually politically go over there. I got to figure out somebody
to All Japan
to All Japan and can have a match that will resonate with people, you know, over here. You know what
and
I mean?
That they can afford. That's the other thing too.
That's true.
These companies that we talk about, All Japan is like the only one that doesn't have any. You know, isn't fully corporate owned or partially corporate owned. I mean, you've got obviously New Japan and Stardom with Bushiroad. You've got DDT and Pro Wrestling Noah with Cyber Agent backing under the Cyber Fight banner. You've got Gaora TV involvement in Dragon Gate. And then you've got All Japan, which is still, you know, sort of hanging on, obviously a shell of what they were, but hanging on to like major minor status. While being, you know, completely independent as compared to those other companies.
You remember when Keiji Muto brought All Japan to the Playboy Mansion?
How could you? How could I ever forget? And if I did, you would never let me forget.
Absolutely not. As this show kind of sort of becomes a full circle of Keiji Muto always figuring out a way. Hey, look, like a lot of guys, he was not only going to figure out a way to survive in the wrestling business, he was going to figure out a way to really survive, because if you're figured in, you can always survive, especially when if it's off somebody else's money. So, Noah, again, it's amazing that the things that we talked about, if somebody were to go back and listen to the very first shows when it comes to wackiness in New Japan, and we got to look. And we did not skip over the Kota Ibushi story, too, as we record this show on Monday, late Monday evening. There's really, everybody knows what Kota has said about his mother now and putting her reported, I guess, suicide attempt.
At that point, we're trying to translate people's tweets, so we don't need to go too far into that particular as we're recording, but suffice to say, if you've been following the Keiji Muto, or excuse me, the Kota Ibushi story, and you were thinking, man, this is just getting harder to follow and more bizarre and harder to see how this ends in a resolution that involves Kota Ibushi being a full-fledged member of the New Japan roster in good standing, I don't think anything that came out today is going to dissuade anyone from that thought. It's very hard to see. I don't see any scenario where we see Kota Ibushi wrestling in New Japan anytime soon.
Yeah, and look, we talk about, you know, wrestling like sport here, and we talk about it and you know, and tie it into sports and things like that. And there's going to be, you know, things with AEW and his future when it comes to wrestling and all that sort of stuff that we'll be able to speculate on, fantasy book, and talk about it as we move forward on things. But when it comes to Kota Ibushi for right now, the only thing I can say, that I'm sure I'm speaking for Adam here too, is we just want everyone to be well, all the wrestling, yes, and all that other stuff be damned, and we just want, hopefully, a good resolution. But bottom line is, whether there's a good resolution or bad resolution business-wise, we just want happy, healthy people, and that's really, at the end of the day, all that matters.
Yeah, 100% would agree with that, that at this point, it's hard to even really think about what he's going to do as a wrestler. It's clear that there's, across the board, is issues with the company and just different things he's dealing with. Just, yeah, want the best for him and everyone involved there. The other thing that we should mention is that have not had a chance to see it yet, but if you're listening to this and you know you want to see something that will be a good show and will also be, you know, supporting a worthy cause on a, you know, on a pretty important day, I'd highly recommend going to Fight TV, to fight.tv, and ordering the replay of the Hanakamura second memorial show, as somehow it's impossible to believe that we're 2 years on now from that tragedy. And yeah, you know, there was a show today. It's, you know, the proceeds are going to Hanakamura's mother and the work that she's doing on that front to honor the legacy of her daughter, to try to stop cyberbullying, all those sorts of things. So definitely check that out. I'm looking forward to ordering and watching that show later as well.
I have so much stuff I need to catch up on. I'm happy I've been able to catch up and stay up with the best of the Super Juniors, which, you know, it's not going to be, I get in a way too, it's just going to be very interesting too, with the 10 matches on the show. It's going to be easy to keep up with, but man, you know, it's not going to be one of those shows you can skip around with or shave any time off of. You got to put in the time, and it'll be interesting to see when we get to that sixth day, as we get to, you know, everything kind of shaking out, if what the reaction is going to be like on Twitter and in the forum and in other places, as far as, you know, these, again, it's a risk. It's an interesting way to do things, but you know, certainly those dedicated shows, what's nice for the heavyweights, that's for sure, just gives you more extra time off.
One thing, just news breaking as I'm looking right now, I'm assuming the date is wrong because it says Sunday, July 24th. No, I guess that's July. I'm thinking June. So, New Japan has announced their next U.S. show post the Forbidden Door show on June 26th. And it's Sunday, July 24th at the Grady Cole Center in Charlotte, North Carolina. It's listed as a night of New Japan Strong action, so I assume this is a Strong taping rather than a Fight TV pay-per-view offering. But there you go, New Japan coming back to the Charlotte area.
If Filthy is not there, I'm not going.
Was it not COVID? Was it that you were protesting what was going to go down with Filthy and the Strong Openweight Championship? Is that why you were not at the New Japan shows last weekend in Washington, D.C. or in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania?
I did not have any inside information on anything that was going to take place on those shows. And in fact, I was feeling some kind of way. I was in deep into my emotional bag over, did I cause Filthy Tom Lawler to lose that title on Sunday? Did me disappointing him not being able to show up because I caught the COVID?
Yeah.
Is that what it was? You know, was I going to be his muse for the weekend? You know, and unfortunately I failed him. And if I was a part of the cause of him to lose, I really do feel upset about that. I mean, he is so used to having his partners fail him and let him down on a regular basis that he is probably used to it. But I feel as though I really did let him down. So I apologize to Filthy.
You're going to get jumped by Danny Limelight while recording live on the air, Wrestling Observer Live. He's going to come into that little shoebox of a studio you have and just hit you.
He should know better. If he even had that thought to wake up and apologize over that. But yeah, hopefully Filthy is there. Unfortunately, not your New Japan Strong Openweight Champion. He's still mine, but he's not yours anymore. For everybody else, it is now Fred Rosser. But interested to see where Filthy goes, what happens with him, and will he be able to garner some revenge in that company? And in fact, even do a little bit more than that. Forget about just getting revenge inside New Japan Strong. I think he should get revenge and be entered into the G1. That's what I myself would like to see.
I was just going to say, I'm considering bringing a giant banner signed to Forbidden Door that says Filthy in G1 or we riot.
Look, you know me. I will actually have a personal riot if Filthy's not in the G1.
I do know you. I was next to you when Enzo and Big Cass showed up at Madison Square Garden for the Ring of Honor New Japan show. So I know you will have a one-man riot.
And I was completely sober. That's the one thing you can't say. Like, how banged up was Mike going into that show? No, that was just Mike.
No, we had milkshakes across the street before we went into the arena.
We went to the Seinfeld diner. That's right. That's right.
Yeah, unless you had a spiked milkshake, I think I think you were on the straight and narrow there. So with that, we should close this out. Some plugs, obviously, Mike. You will tell the people how to subscribe to WrestlingObserver.com/F4WOnline.com, so you can go back and hear 450 previous episodes of this podcast, in addition to everything else that takes place over there on that website. But if for some reason you still want to hear more of me podcasting, you can check out Wrestling at Random, which is on whatever podcast service you are listening to this show right now. Just search Wrestling at Random. It's the show that I do each and every week with Jeremy Deamer, talking about a classic pro wrestling show chosen at random. It could be anything, and believe me, it is. We're in the middle of our season break right now, but there are over 100 episodes of evergreen content that you can go back and listen to for free. Also, you can go to adamsummers.substack.com and read the 3-Count Fall newsletter, which comes out every week, talking in written word about the same topics that we talk about here most weeks on the Big Audio Nightmare, going in depth on the Japanese scene. For free, again, check out adamsummers.substack.com. And then also, Mike, I know you have quite a few things going on beyond just this podcast.
Oh, yeah. We've got a couple of irons in the fire, but my favorite side chick in the whole wide world, you guys know what it is. It's the Mid-Atlantic Championship Podcast, which you can find at midatlanticpod.com. It is a tribute to Jim Crockett Promotions from 1933 to 1988. All of your warm and fuzzy memories brought back to life for you. No politics over there, no nonsense, no modern times, none of that stuff. Just the best stuff from my childhood, from your childhood, and from the childhood that you didn't even know that you had. You're going to see stuff that maybe you've seen in modern wrestling, and now you know where they got it from. You're going to see things that could still be used in modern wrestling today, and you're going to see things that, thank God, you will never see in professional wrestling again that took place in Jim Crockett Promotions over all of those years. The Twitter feed is the thing that I'm most proud of. I love the podcast. We do the weekly TV shows as well as specials. Weekly TV shows, which you can follow along with on the WWE Network on Peacock. If you have old DVDs or tapes from WWE classics of the Mid-Atlantic shows that were up there, those are the ones we review, as well as doing some special editions as well. But it's the Twitter feed that I love to do the most. I get to post up old clips from wrestling shows, old audio and things like that. So Mid-Atlantic Pod on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook groups, Instagram. We have a Patreon as well, too, patreon.com/midatlanticpodcast. So a zillion and one ways to keep up with your favorite side chick in pro wrestling, my favorite, the Mid-Atlantic Championship Podcast. But I wouldn't be able to do that show if I wasn't doing this right here. Not only the Big Audio Nightmare, but Wrestling Observer Live, which you can also listen to free every single day. Just go to WrestlingObserver.com for all of the details on how you can both view and listen to that broadcast. WrestlingObserver.com is where you want to be anyway. $12.99 a month. credit card, PayPal. If you got Bitcoin, we take that as well, too, our fearless leaders here at the Empire. No matter how you want to give us money, we will take your money and give you access to a ridiculous number of 450 shows for us. There's about 10 trillion shows in that archive, 10 trillion hours worth between Brian and Vinny shows and all of the other shows on the website, Wrestling Observer Lives, Wrestling Observer Radios with Dave, Carl Stern, Filthy Tom Lawler, Antonio the Promise Thomas, Lance Storm, just tons and tons of audio and now video up at the WrestlingObserver.com site, as well as, oh yeah, the Wrestling Observer newsletter by Dave Meltzer, which is still about 50 trillion words a week, and some of the smallest print that you can still get, hard copy sent to your house. But most sane people, they're looking at it on the website, WrestlingObserver.com. A ton of shows there, a ton of stuff for you to go back and listen to, a ton of newsletters, history, all that sort of stuff. Come check it out today.
Wow. A professional podcaster, professionally podcasting. Mike Sempervivi, close it out.
The Adam and Mike Big Audio Nightmare. We shall be back soon.